Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to a brand new and bonus edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you every week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS, and joining me to celebrate the work of Mr. Lee Child, creator of the Jack Reacher novels, is Spectator Literary Editor and one of my favourite TLS contributors, Sam Leith. Sam has written an essay this week on why the Jack Reacher novels, one copy of which is sold allegedly every 4 seconds somewhere in the world, why are they so good? And Sam, this all started because of our feature on the best novelists currently writing today, and you decided to nominate Lee Child.
Yes, he wasn't my only nomination, no. I should say, in my defence.
Is that right? I seem to remember him being your only nomination in the
No. It was the end of a long list of okay. Nobel Prize candidates. Yeah, but yeah. I did think that there was a case to be made that within his genre, he's doing his best work, and it is, you know, at very, very high level. The thing is,
do we even need to say within his genre? That seems to me an interesting question, because is he not just writing, you know, there are no genres, there's just good books and bad books, and he writes generally good books.
Well, he does write good books. I mean, I think, the argument about genre and what literary fiction is and all the rest of it is one for another day and an even longer podcast. But yeah. I think he writes books that work on a fairly sort of stripped down and simple level. I mean, you don't look to Reacher for profundity. You know, there's no reason that books have to be profound. What's slightly annoying, of course, is that, you know, one puts in, well, I think Lee Child's doing great work, because you think this is going to be something that people will go, the lowbrow, the violator, you know. And unfortunately, you know, every writer you talk to practically says, you know, wants to be the one who's spotted Lee Child. And of course, you know, he's almost universally adored.
Well, I reply with, I fucking love Lee Child.
Exactly. And it's like wanting to have seen, you know, Supergrass when there were still the Jennifers. You know, you want to be the one who's discovered him and who's you know, breaking this secret on the world, and you're always, you know, the last.
Well, one of the reasons I commissioned the piece, because when I interviewed Philip Pullman about his books, we were sitting in his living room afterwards, and I said, well, what books do you read? And he was telling me he likes thrillers. And then he said out of nowhere, and I love Lee Child. And then he tweeted about it, and I said, he tweeted, the TLS should run a piece about why Lee Child is so, so good, which is why we've ended up here, Sam,
directed by
Philip Pullman. But, so what is it? Let's try one, because there's plenty of genre novels. There's plenty of sophisticated genre novels, and there have been for 100 years. Why is this hitting a zeitgeist?
Is it
something about modernity that requires the existence of Jack Reacher?
Well, I think yes, Jack Reacher, obviously the character is central to it. You know, there are series novels and they've got this very attractive and compelling character.
Explain who he is, because people might be listening.
Okay, he's a former military policeman. And, you know, as the books make clear, being a military policeman means you're even tougher than all the people in the army, because you're the person who kicks the arses of the people in the army who step out of line. So he's already super tough. He's, you know, completely sort of enormous. I mean, he's a Frankenstein's monster type character. Somewhere in the books is, I think, his shoulder blades, his shoulders are described as resembling basketballs.
And he's got a 6'5", 50-inch chest. His chest is so muscular, you say, that in one of the early novels it stops a bullet.
Yes, it does actually stop a bullet. I mean, he's a bit sore for the next novel or two, but
he's fine.
There's just so much wadded muscle there. But
he doesn't work out. In my little intro to the paper, I say he's so anti-modernity that he has this amazing body, which is quite a modern thing to have, but it's not the product of Pilates and going to the gym. He's just born with it.
He eats, you know, almost exclusively, you know, pancakes and bacon and hamburgers.
Yeah, black coffee.
And drinks black coffee. Yeah. I think the modernity point is one of them, because, you know, when you meet him, and in the archetypal position in most of the books, is it begins with him blowing into town somewhere. He just wanders like Thistledown all over America. I think he's lost his passport somewhere along the way or never had one. And so he doesn't really travel abroad very much. He just roams America. He's a former military policeman. So he's someone who's outside, you know, all of society's rules and regulations. And he's absolutely minimal. I think the great attraction of him and the attraction of the prose in some ways is that it's stripped down, as many thriller writers' prose is. But the character itself is a sort of, you know, he doesn't want anything.
No.
He's freed from what Eliot called in the metalled paths of appetency and desire. He simply wanders around animated, as far as I can tell, just by curiosity. And he'll kind of cross America from one corner to the other just because it strikes him as like
and
a nice
freedom,
idea.
I think, because he was in the army for so long where every part of his day was measured, that he wants to live in a time where he can just get on a bus and the bus will take him. It's often a bus he travels on, even
yes,
rather than a train.
Yes, bus or he hitchhikes. I mean, very often, you know, the sort of, you know, or again, the archetypal setup, and it's a series that moves towards being more archetypal rather than away from it.
Yeah.
Is it begins with him thumbing a ride.
Yeah.
And it ends with him, or stepping off a bus, and it ends with him by the side of the road, either about to climb on another bus or thumb another ride. It's like The Littlest Hobo with extreme violence, as I've thought of it. But he's attractive. I read the novels backwards, weirdly, because I read the most recent one and then just sort of binge-read them. Lots of people binge-read them.
I read the whole thing in a year.
But I oddly binge-read them from back to front, which was an interesting experience because you saw all the stuff being whittled away. You know, he starts in a condition, because as he is, he owns nothing except the clothes that he stands up in, a bank card, whereas, you know, he has a bank account with some money in it, for his military pension or whatever that it is, and a folding toothbrush.
Yeah.
And that's it. He's very keen on the folding toothbrush, presumably, because, you know...
Which goes in his top pocket.
Yeah, a full-size toothbrush would sort of, you know, tie him down. And whenever his clothes get dirty, he simply goes into a shop, buys some new clothes, changes in the change room, and throws the old clothes in the bin. He does this in
minutes. But that's why we must be getting to a close to, in a world driven by consumerism gone mad, and of, you know, he wouldn't be on Facebook, he wouldn't be on Twitter. This world, he's totally off the grid. And that is an American tradition, because I was thinking, you know, Emerson wrote that essay about self-reliance, and there is an American archetype. The idea of the hitchhiker is very American. The idea of a man with no name,
the lone gunman drifting into town. Yeah. I mean, he's in a huge, you know, and I think Lee Child's very conscious about this. I mean, I think he's described him as a paladin. You know, he's an archetype that goes to medieval romance via the Western, you know, of this lone do-gooding wanderer. And I think there's also another archetype that occurs is the Japanese one of the Ronin, the masterless samurai. Because the thing with Reacher is, though he lives outside society's rules, he's very, very rule-governed himself. In fact, there was even a spin-off book called Reacher's Rules, which included all the kind of little rules he had for how you have to sit in a restaurant to avoid being ambushed if gunmen come in through the door, you know, when you should eat,
kick the people's knees. He's very good. He's very good at finding the weaknesses. Don't mess around.
Yes, lots of the rules are about fighting. For instance, you know, you always use your elbows because elbows don't break and fists do.
Yeah.
You know, always hit your opponents. You know, say, I'll count to three and then I'll hit you and then hit them on two. So he fights dirty, doesn't he? I think the stripped downness is one of the attractions because, as you say, in modern life and indeed in most fiction, characters go through life accumulating more baggage and Reacher goes through life doing the opposite. You know, he's got less and less and less. And he's attractive in the way that lots of those archetypes are, in that he is invulnerable. You know, he's got freedom to and freedom from, as I put it in my piece of TLS. You know, both of us are Boleyn's sorts, because he's freedom from anyone messing with him.
Yeah.
Because he's built like a brick shit house and incredibly good at violence. And freedom too, and there's nothing in tying him down at all. And he can do what he likes. And so he's got that, I mean, that really basic thing that, you know, half the audience, you know, would like to be him, and the other half of the audience would like to be sort of swept up in his...
Well, that's it. I was going to ask that question. Is he... Because the people that you name who like him, if you include the two of us, Philip Pullman, Rick Gukoski, and Malcolm Gladwell, are all gentlemen. Do we feel he's a very male figure? Is he like... I was looking at the blurbs. I've got the short story book, and actually there's Patricia Cornwell, Karen Slaughter, Lucy Mangan, the rest are all men. Do you think he's a very attractive to men, or is he attractive to...
I think he
sells so many. I mean, lots of women must be buying him as well.
I know anecdotally just as many women as men who really like it. And I don't think that is a sort of romantic projection thing if we're going, always a tough man, women are... You know, I think women seem to enjoy it for the same reason that men enjoy it, which is the sort of perfect freedom, the character. And certainly the reading data seems to suggest that women as well, it's not a boy's book particularly. I mean, I think the sexual politics of Reacher are quite interesting because he does, in some ways, he looks like he's going to conform to that kind of James Bond, love him and leave him kind of character. But he's not hugely promiscuous. He doesn't take a tumble with any... I mean, his freedom from connections means he's not... you know, romantically connected to anybody. No. But there's no great cruelty or sadism or exploitation in the way he is. In fact, his relationship with women is more, you know, now we've got different sex parts, you know, it might be nice to go to bed. But actually the women he likes, he tends to like and respect not because of the way they're built, but because of the way they think and the way they behave and their independence of action.
And he's kind of weirdly a serial monogamist with the women he meets.
Very abbreviated serial monogamist.
But there's one woman in town who he's helping at some level. They sleep together, but she is as keen for him to leave town in the end as he is to leave town, generally speaking.
Yes.
Like she doesn't want him to stay and he's leaving her. They just both say, we've had a lovely time, we've resolved the narrative situation, we've had sex 5 to 10 times.
We've resolved the narrative situation, yeah. Exactly.
We've had sex 5 to 10 times, and that was lovely. Let's all move on with our lives.
Yes,
and
his most meaningful relationship with a woman in the books is with one of the very, very few recurring characters who sort of actually matters very much, who's this character called Frances Neagley, who's an old colleague. And Neagley... you know, he adores Neagley because she's a sort of female Reacher. She's just as good at snapping necks as he is. You know, he respects her professional, you know, terrifying military acuity. But there's no sexual frisson between them. She doesn't even like being touched. Yeah. She's a sort of nolimitangri. Somebody me toos her with a slap on the bottom and they'll end up with their teeth in the back of their head. So it's certainly not a kind of, you know, James Bond style creepy sexual wish fulfillment vibe in these novels at all. In fact, sex isn't very important in them, I don't think.
And is he doing this consciously? I'm fascinated. I don't know that much about Lee Child, but he's English. He's born in the West Midlands, I think.
Yeah.
And he's writing these uber Americana books. They're so American. Like I said, there's a, you know, Emersonian American, Western American. There are, in the tradition, very American tradition. Is he doing it consciously? And his writing methods?
I imagine so. I don't know Lee Child. I've never met him. I've read a little about him, but...
He writes interestingly, doesn't he? So to explain his writing method, these are quite tightly plotted in some senses in that they're quite coherent, they're quite pared down.
Yeah, they don't leave many. I mean, I think one of the really attractive things about these novels is, you know, which is why they stand out above their genre and indeed above an awful lot of, you know, the bad writing that stands for literary fiction.
Indeed.
Is that he doesn't get anything much wrong. The sentences are good, the plots are tight, you know, occasionally there'll be something that's just really downright silly. There's one in which people keep turning up dead in bathtubs covered in camouflage paint, and the explanation for why that's happened is really silly. But for the most part, they're just really well-oiled, well-squared away. They move at exactly the pace they need to. There's something interesting happening exactly as often as it needs to. And I think this is one of the, you know, things that's important about the way thrillers work. You know, you say, like, Dan Brown is somebody who can't write for toffee, and yet something works about his books because he knows how...
Do you think that's right? I don't agree with that. I think Dan Brown's a really illustrious... Because I interviewed Dan Brown, and he said he liked books with facts in them. And I was like, well, why don't you read non-fiction books? That's the... But no, he likes to read fiction books with facts. And he says with him, you get your greens, your daily greens, but you get a bit of ice cream as well. So you learn that Uber was invented in 2007... But you also get someone falling out of a window being chased by a shadowy Catholic cult. And they seem to be so written in bad faith, those books, and so completely ill-considerate of anything of value. They're just sort of churned out facts with a hokey plot surrounded. But that Lee Child seems to start from the base of something so much simpler.
Oh, he does. No, I was using the comparator only to say that even a writer as bad as Dan Brown can make something work if you pace it right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, I mean, the pacing of those books and the speed with which the plot turns around is what makes them work.
Yeah.
But Child not only can pace and plot well, but he writes extremely well and economically. He's got this kind of well worked out and attractive character. And they all sort of slot together in a way that you can read them continuously, and there's a sort of arc or story going on. But, you know, also, as I think they say at the end of each one, you know, the Jack Reacher novels can be read in any order.
Yeah.
However, the next one is.
You buy them. You
know, yes, just keep buying them.
Just keep buying them. You know. Is it replicable forever then, do you think? Because there's no...
I can't see why he can't go on doing it forever. I mean, I think it...
Explain how he writes them. So he writes them once
a year. Oh, yes, this is the thing. I'm indebted for this to Andy Martin's book, Reacher Said Nothing, where he basically kind of slightly stalked Lee Child and sat over his shoulder while he watched, I think it's the 20th novel, Make Me. I think it's the 20th, and I think it was Make Me that he was reading. And to my general astonishment... It turns out that Lee Child will start a novel always on the same day every year. So, you know, he writes for an absolute schedule, and he sits down with, you know, a million cigarettes and a huge pint of black coffee and starts hammering away at his computer, and he has no idea what's going to happen. So this book in question begins with a guy called Kiva being buried in the middle of nowhere by some guys operating a backhoe.
That's right. I don't think this is one of the best ones, actually. I don't think this is a particularly strong one.
No, it's a perfectly OK one. It's a pretty good one. But, you know, anyone says, oh, what's going to happen? And Lee Child says, oh, I don't know. And he hadn't noticed that Kiva was the same size as Reacher or that his name kind of rhymed with Reacher. And he just sort of follows along. And this is surprising, I think, because as far as I know, most thriller writers... have some sort of idea for who'd done it, what's been done, what's going to be done, how it's going to be uncovered. And Charles seems to feel his way pretty much. I mean, I once heard it said that Agatha Christie used to write her books all the way through and then at the end decide who did it and then go back and rewrite them to figure out, you know, to make it possible for that person to have done it. But
she's kind of possible, I suppose.
Yes, but also it turned out annoyingly to be apocryphal because I've read a biography of Agatha Christie and said, no, she plotted them incredibly carefully. Yeah.
There's a bit in John Bookham where he talks about, in the Richard Hannay novels, which are my favourite, one of my favourite sets of novels ever, but they talk about how you solve, it's in The Three Hostages where there's an impossible set of clues. And they're talking about a thriller writer, how you'd write it. And he says, the point is, you know, you solve these things. The thriller writer has the three killer clues at the beginning and then solves the puzzle himself and then writes backwards from that, which seems to be obviously that's how it works. But he doesn't do
that.
That's
an obvious way of doing it.
But as you say, these are never whodunits.
The other things about them, which is to bear in mind, is they're not action novels. They contain a great deal of action, a great deal of violence. And the violence set pieces are part of what makes them fun because... You know, Reacher is attacked by, you know, 5 people or 10 people or 20 people wielding baseball bats. Yeah. And it's always, ooh, how much are they going to regret it this time? Because he's totally indestructible. Yeah. In that respect, he's like Robert B. Parker's character Spencer, who's another kind of paladin. Yeah. But they're actually mostly not about action happening forwards. What normally happens is he stumbles into a situation. You know, he's in a small town and sort of trouble finds him. He seldom goes looking for it. It's always that something catches his attention or his curiosity or somebody tries to kill him or kidnap him, which happens more often to him than to most tourists. And then he kind of figures out what's going on and puts an end to it.
Yeah.
But it's very seldom the plot is proceeding forward. It's normally he's kind of more a detective almost than an action
hero. There's no suspense, is there? Because in the end, we know who the baddies are generally. And it's just a question of at what point he rumbles who they are and then he brings some ass-kicking justice to them to enable him to move on. It's nothing more complicated than that, is it?
I think not.
I mean, quite often the blurbs on the back set up a problem that's resolved in the first 30 pages. Like, Reacher's been arrested, will he go to prison for life? And then sort of after about 30 pages, it's clear, no, he won't, he'll carry on.
I have to remember that blurbs are, you know, the same Daily Mail headline principle applies. That
Let's put him in context then. So you mentioned Marlowe. Obviously, Raymond Chandler's Marlowe. You mentioned Spence by Robert B. Parker. Another one I've read all of his books.
Yes.
There are about 30 of them.
In this respect, our tastes align quite closely. I think Spence is a decent comparator because he's another of these characters who endures, who can't quite age in real time.
So just be clear, he's a Boston private eye, Spencer. He's written by Robert B. Park, who's now dead.
The Dean of American Crime Fiction. Less appreciated over here, unfortunately, than in the States.
Because he's actually written some very good... Because he's also written some good historical novels, one about Jackie Robinson, which is very good, about the black baseball player.
Yeah.
But he's... Spencer is this recurring character. He's a Boston private eye. He's got a girlfriend who is a... very annoying girlfriend. He's got a best mate who's a black guy called Hawk, who the prose absolutely... falls in love with. It has these amazing descriptions of his sort of pure body and amazing strength, and it really values strength, doesn't it, that they work out all the time in the same gym.
They're constantly working out, and the attraction of Spencer again is that he's indestructible, like, you know, which is the odd thing about these novels, is that they're enjoyable even though what, you know, TV producers like to call jeopardy is absent, in the sense that nobody's ever going to be able to kill these heroes. They're unkillable, and you know, Spencer is the toughest guy in Boston, except possibly for Hawk, who's his best friend. Yeah. So, you know, when Spencer meets somebody who constitutes even a tiny bit of a threat, he simply drafts in Hawk, and the two of them kind of flatten whoever the baddie is.
Yeah.
But they're similar characters because, you know, you mentioned Marlowe. Parker was very consciously a kind of Chandler copyist. Yeah. I mean, he finished one of Chandler's unfinished novels. He imitated Chandler's style and very dialogue-heavy, sardonic, kind of dry style. And, you know, I think Chandler did describe Marlowe as being a paladin, and Spencer, I mean, is always described as being, you know, spelt with an S to give the early modern kind of literary resonances.
It makes occasional references to the Fairy Queen and things like that.
Oh, it does,
it does.
And he's
literate, isn't it?
And he has a lot, you know, he's very often... You know, he will say in a kind of deadpan way, you know, my strength is as of 10 men because my heart is pure.
Yeah.
And so we just like that archetype, that kind of, you know, absolutely rule-based, absolutely indestructible, imperturbable, unweigh-downable, totally free yet totally good.
And the jeopardy's an interesting question, because a lot of thrillers are based around jeopardy, as you say, but I read a lot of thrillers, I think, probably more than is good for me. When there's genuine jeopardy, you kind of half know it's going to resolve itself. So it's always slightly tainted. And then secondly, I find you speed up your reading because you need to get to the bit where that jeopardy is resolved in one way or another. So actually the enjoyment of reading pages 50 to, say, 250 is reduced because you speed up and up and up and up. There's a sort of telltale compression of pages, as Jane Austen puts it. You know, quick, 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 quick. Oh, I get to the end. Whereas with Reacher, it slows you down. And Spencer, I think it's the same. You know that there's no jeopardy. And so actually you can just enjoy the journey more because you're not constantly hunting for the end. Do you think there's no puzzle solving? You know, puzzle solving novels, you're constantly... Looking ahead to it.
I think we're maybe underselling the extent to which the plot draws you forward in these things. I mean, they're not completely zen. You do normally have, even if you're fairly confident he's going to resolve it, you're not always certain how. So, you know, the sort of jeopardy is present, but of course with series characters, the jeopardy is never quite existential because, you know, you can be fairly confident however many novels into the series that he's not going to kill off Reacher.
No, I hope he doesn't.
No, me neither.
I've realised.
Then I'd have to start reading literature.
Yeah. Who else do you read like this, then, before we get just to the end? Who else in the series? Because I've mentioned this to you before, John D. MacDonald, the Travis McGee novels, which people who don't know them, they are, there's 30 of them probably, that each have a colour in the title, and they're about a Florida beach bum who has this amazing boat, and he's taking his retirement one chunk at a time. So every time he runs out of money, he saves someone and takes a cut of the money he recovers on their behalf. And his sidekick, which is completely different to Hawk, is Mayer, an economist, whose boat is called the J. Maynard Keynes.
Is it the protagonist? His boat's called the Busted Flush.
The Busted Flush because he won it in a poker game. But again, these are books that they're joyous to read. It's because they're written in the 60s. There's a tiny hint of Bondian misogyny, which isn't pronounced that much. But often when you read, I mean, I read a lot of James Bond again recently, and I didn't really enjoy it. It weren't particularly well plotted, weren't particularly interesting. Once you got past the existence of the character, they weren't that fun. Are you a Bond fan?
Ish.
But not.
I like the movies.
Yeah, the book. Yeah, I thought the books were going to be better than they were. Anyway, so Travis McGee, they're very good.
John D. MacDonald. I like Carl Harrison, who's a kind of John D. MacDonald descendant. Yeah, I know this is where we differ. Because,
well, I read again. I read Double Whammy again after our last conversation.
And
I just couldn't. I just couldn't do it for me. It was well enough written. Of course, his brother very sadly died in that shooting. And did you see that?
I saw that. Yes.
Astonishing. And he was obviously very. He was very strong on it. It was beautiful to read. But no, I found him. It was too funny. Yeah, it was two attempts to be jocular. I tell you what, I like
Jim Thompson, who I think is very funny, though not jocular at all.
That's dark, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he was was he 50s?
I think, yeah, 50s
what
roughly.
Did he write? What was his 50s.
Well, the film, he wrote a novel or novella that was made into The Grifters. Mm. And there's The Devil Inside Me and Pop 1320 or something.
The one with a serial killing policeman.
Yes, I can't remember what that one's called. I think that might be The Population.
And that was made into a movie, wasn't it?
They're all very sort of slightly off the level in the sense that, you know, it appears to be doing something a bit realistic, but actually there's almost a kind of descent into hell in some of them.
A bit American Psycho, even, the one I was thinking of, because it was putting you in the mind of someone who, at one level, is attractive in the sense of he's in control, but then he ends up...
Is that The Killer Inside Me? The Killer Inside Me, yeah.
Yeah, I think that possibly is that one. I tell you one I started reading, but I'm not sure I'm going to bother with all, because there's hundreds of them. The 87th Precinct novels of Ed McBain. Have you heard of him?
Oh, yes. Ivan Hunter, as he's...
Yeah, and he wrote... He wrote a film that was fairly successful, I think. But any...
A very, very famous film. Was it The Birds? Might have been The Birds.
It might have been The Birds, yeah. And that's a police procedural.
Yes.
87th Precinct, and there's hundreds of them.
Hundreds and hundreds. And, yeah, I've read a bunch.
They're quite good.
I think they're good. Yeah. I mean, they feel a bit dated now, but I saw him recently interviewed, and somebody... I think they had a whole thing where somebody had spoken relatively... They said, you know, you've written this novel about the police, and he said, I think I am the preeminent police procedural writer in the English language, I think you'll find. And so he's untroubled by low self-esteem, that man.
Joseph Wambo, have you ever read him? He did The Choir Boys, which is another police procedural. And then there's maybe inheritor of all of that, which is a slightly more populist, is Don Winslow, who wrote the Cartel books about Mexican crime, which are just absurdly violent and brilliant, I think.
Are we allowed to stick Damon Runyon in there?
Yeah, I think so.
He's a sort of crime novelist.
Yeah, I think that's,
short story writer.
Are we allowed James Ellroy?
Oh, yes, we have to have James Ellroy.
Ellroy is possibly my favourite novelist ever. Yes. I read American Tabloid. I've read that in the double figures and Cold 6000. So I don't know what it is. Why are we attracted to these things in some? Just leave it on this. Why are we? So the American Tabloid is about bad people, but they're kind of charming. They're super violent. But they have a... Is there a simplicity that we're craving? Is there a narrative resolution that we seek?
I think there's some of the, you know, seeing justice done to the unrighteous is always fun. And I think something about the rule-based structured world of crime and thriller.
Yeah.
You know that there's going to be sort of action and reaction and somebody's going to end up, you know, at the bottom of the sea.
And probably the bad guy. And they might complicate you.
Unless it's Jim Thompson.
Yeah, they might complicate who that is. But even then, you kind of know, don't you? I think it's about certainty. I think it is about, in increasingly uncertain times, or they've always been uncertain. Like, real life is uncertain and messy and full of dead ends and all of that. And these books never are.
Yes, let people write literary novels about real life. We can have, you know, as Peter O'Rourke said of Harrison, you know, this is better than literature.
Better than literature. Is Lee Child better than literature? Yes.
I think so.
Yes. Let's leave it there. Sam Lee, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.